Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to explain some of our upcoming programs before we start. As Mike mentioned earlier, we have about 40 events a year. Some are discussions, but we also have a Monday Night Philosophy series, second Monday of every month. I'll tell you about the ones that are coming up. In January on the 11th, we have Maleva Lewis talking about the values that guide healthcare decisions. She's an RN. Oh, is it not working? It should be on.
It's probably too low.
Oh, sorry. Is that better?
It is now, yes.
Okay, great. The values that guide healthcare is what she's going to talk about. She's an RN, works with hospice situations, and she's in a program that worked out a way to try to decide how to make these difficult decisions at the end of life. So that's one. In February, we have a panel, a discussion on the morality of warfare. Since we know that warfare probably will be with us forever, is there a way to kind of hem it in with our rules, or is it just impossible to do that? But that's what the panel discussion is going to be about in February. And on March 14th, I'll be giving my annual talk, this one on Thomas More's utopian humor. It's the 500th anniversary of the book Utopia. Seems like just yesterday, you know? So those are the next three. On Tuesday, our next lecture, we don't have anything else for the rest of the year, amazingly. But on January 5th, we have Professor Patrick Iber coming to speak about poets, painters, and spies, the Cultural Cold War in Latin America. Now, Cultural Cold War in Latin America, he's a professor at the University of Texas, and he has written about how the Soviet Union and the United States and Britain and France sort of all had this thing going after World War II where they would compete with each other about how great their literary artists were, and would fill up the libraries in Europe with their greatest writers and so on, so that the local population would read it and be in favor of their culture and in favor of capitalism versus communism. And there were a lot of strange things that happened, but he focused a little bit on Latin America and what happened there. A lot of very famous writers got pulled into that maelstrom, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Borgia, so forth, and how it didn't work out for anybody, sort of the usual situation. There's one very funny story that I'm going to tell from his book, which just showed one thing, which is that everybody had something in common, and that is Allen Ginsberg, being a leftist, was invited by Radio Marti in Cuba to come and speak, and so he was being interviewed live before they learned not to do that. Interviewed live, they asked him about Che Guevara and what he thought of Che Guevara. And he said, oh, he's a great man. He's just a wonderful man. I'm very, very proud of him. He's very handsome, too. And then he paused for a second. As a matter of fact, last night I had an erotic dream about him. Pulled the plug. I think in 1961, the capitalists, the communists, everybody would have pulled the plug on Allen Ginsberg if that's what he was going to go off on. So that's part of the background for Patrick's speech. That's just one of the funny stories. It was very interesting because can you imagine anybody in their discussions today like lining up their literary artists and say, we've got the better, you know, I don't think anybody would even think about it. So those are a few that are coming up. We have lots more. We have T.J. Stiles coming in February 25th to speak about his new book, Custer's Trials, about he's written a revisionist biography about General Custer. Probably since Little Big Man, he hasn't really had a great reputation. So I don't think he's going to save his reputation, but he's got a new idea about him. So those are a few of our programs coming up in the new year. And as I said, we probably have about 40 altogether. So if there aren't any questions, if you've turned off your phone, and we'll go a whole hour here. I mean, we'll go until 10 after 7, so usual. If no other questions, we'll officially start. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Ben Griffin, one of the editors at the Mark Twain Papers at the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley, here in just across the bay. As I was saying a little bit earlier, they have probably, undoubtedly, the best collection of Mark Twain papers. There's several other repositories, but this is certainly the most extensive collection. And they've done a very interesting job over the time. And I was saying earlier how they actually followed his dictate and published the autobiography 100 years after his death, because he didn't want to get his relatives killed for the things that he said in it. One thing that was very interesting about it was that they figured that the first run for that would be about 5,000 or 10,000 copies or 15,000 copies, something like that. It sold over 300,000 copies or even more than that. Ben made 500,000 copies of the first edition of that. It made a great Christmas present for one thing, I think. But in any case, tonight Ben is going to be talking about Twain's interest in sort of made up apocryphal stories about the infant Jesus, about Satan. Those of you who have read The Mysterious Stranger, which was sort of edited out of some manuscripts that were left over but not published by Twain's biographer, a man named Payne, and he turned it into a story. But in there, there's a young Satan. There's the nephew of Satan. So that's the one story that's well known. But everything else that he wrote, which is extensive, was only unpublished and published later by different editors, and now more stuff's come up. So I'm going to let Ben tell you all about this idea because he's got a fascinating take on it. Thank you very much for coming, Ben.
Thank you, George. And thank you for letting me come and speak to you tonight about something which isn't the autobiography of Mark Twain. I've done my share of speaking about the autobiography, and it's fascinating. But I'm very happy to be able to share research of my own tonight that will undoubtedly feed in at some time to a Mark Twain Papers volume. I'm sure it will. I just don't see exactly how. And so why am I sure? Well, maybe I'm not. But in any case, I'm absolutely positive that this is interesting material. What I'm not so sure about is whether I've made it adequately clear. I'm really gratified to see a big group of people here who want to hear about this, and the more so as I've discovered that the big party is going on upstairs. You know, I you people are hardcore. That's all I can say. So I'm going to talk about Mark Twain's Apocrypha. Can everyone hear this all right? Is it good? Wonderful. What is meant by my phrase, Mark Twain's Apocrypha? His Apocrypha could mean his compositions which emulate or parody scripture or pose as scripture. Throughout his writing life, Mark Twain wrote a lot of this kind of thing. He has written personal diaries that are by Adam, Eve, Shem, Methuselah. He's written infancy gospels, that is to say, stories about the advent of a miraculous or wonder-working baby or stranger. Most importantly, the fragments about a mysterious stranger, which he wrote late in life. That's what I'm going to be talking about mostly tonight. In this fragment, which is in the Mark Twain Papers, The Chronicle of Young Satan, Mark Twain draws upon an apocryphal gospel with its own fascinating history to create an apocryphon of his own, preaching his own mature and late in life gospel. Examining that, I think we can see Mark Twain's connections to a somewhat subterranean literature of free thought and free thinking, which I think is very interesting, and it's not very Christmassy, but I do think it's very interesting. And also, I think we can see the fascinations of the condition of being apocryphal. What is it to be apocryphal? To be a book which resembles, but isn't, Holy Scripture. The Chronicle of Young Satan is an unfinished manuscript. That's what should be showing right there. That Mark Twain wrote in Vienna when he was living there with his family between 1897 and 1900. So the classic fin de siècle Vienna circumstances. It's set also in Austria. It's set in 1702 Austria, which Clemens, who doesn't have a very detailed take on history, Clemens considers 1702 to be the Middle Ages. everywhere. In the case of Austria, he's possibly not far off the mark, but, you know, obviously an impressionistic attitude towards history is Clemens's strong point. The narrator of the Chronicle of Young Satan is Theodor Fischer, an average village boy. And the mysterious visitor who comes to the village and befriends him looks like a boy, but he is 16,000 years old and an angel. The visitor's name is Satan, and he's the nephew of the better-known Satan. He has magical powers and godlike intellect and contempt for what mankind calls the moral sense. He himself is without sin. All the angels, Satan tells us, are without sin, except for the original Satan, who personally transgressed. And in this, I think we see Clemens reacting against the Calvinist theology of his upbringing, in which, of course, people have original sin and are guilty of something that they themselves did not do. He rebelled against that and was very, very offended by it and very inculcated with it, too. In what's perhaps the most memorable occurrence in this story, at least it's the one they picked out for the film, young Satan forms animals and birds out of clay and gives them life. The animals romp around and fight each other, and the birds fly away. And then Satan makes little humans out of clay, and they go about their business. And I'm quoting, "While Satan talked, he made a crowd of little men and women the size of your finger, and they went diligently to work and cleared and leveled off a space a couple of yards square in the grass and began to build a cunning little castle in it, the women mixing the mortar and carrying it up the scaffoldings in pails on their heads. When two of his little creations start fighting, young Satan, without breaking off conversation, casually crushes them. He wipes the red from his fingers on his handkerchief, and the wives of the little dead figurines cry over the bodies, and a little priest prays over them. Now Satan destroys the entire population with the board seat of a swing. Theodore and his friends are aghast. Privately, they call it murder. But Satan, who is without sin and without the moral sense, is unmoved. He rejects their attitude, and he says their moral sense is a delusion and a pretension. In relation to these little clay people, this Satan is, of course, God. Not the God of Christianity, but the God Mark Twain thinks we experience in this world, the indifferent creator and destroyer. In 1950, a literary scholar named Gladys Bellamy pointed out the literary source for this episode in Chronicle. She was guided to it by an 1867 newspaper article by Mark Twain. Yes, Mark Twain's source was an article by himself that he had written 30 years earlier. And it goes further back than that. In June 1867, Mark Twain was in New York on his way to take ship for Europe and the Holy Land, the trip that was going to give him the information he needed to write The Innocents Abroad. In an article for the San Francisco Alta California, he was their regular correspondent, he reported that, "In one of the libraries here, I have found an edition of 1621 of the Apocryphal New Testament. It is rather a curious book." And the date is wrong. 1621 should say 1821. It's either a misprint or an attempt to make his reading sound more arcane than it actually is. Mark Twain says that this apocryphal New Testament has many chapters devoted to the infancy of the Savior and the miracles that he wrought. Here are some of the chapter summaries that Mark Twain quoted in the article. "A young man who had been bewitched and turned into a mule, miraculously cured by the infant Savior being put on his back, and is married to the girl who had been cured of leprosy, whereupon the bystanders praise God." Chapter 19, "Jesus charged with throwing a boy from the roof of a house, miraculously causes the dead boy to speak and acquit him, makes fish pools on the Sabbath, and causes a boy to die who broke them down. Another boy runs against him, whom he also causes to die, whereupon the bystanders," etc., etc. "Sent to a schoolmaster, refuses to tell his letters," that is, say his ABCs, "and the schoolmaster, going to whip him, his hand withers and he dies. Then said Joseph unto Mary, henceforth, we will not allow him to go out of the house, for everyone who displeases him is killed. his society was pleasant, but attended by serious drawbacks. It's the next passage, however, that is the key to Bellamy's and my purposes. Jesus and the other boys play together and make clay figures of animals. Jesus causes them to walk, also makes clay birds, which he causes to fly and eat and drink. The children's parents are alarmed and take Jesus for a sorcerer and order them to seek better company. The exotic gospel that Mark Twain is reading from is known as the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. It's not to be confused with another writing which later was called the Gospel of Thomas II, which is a Gnostic gospel, something else entirely. The authorship and original language of the Infancy Gospel are unknown, but it was pretty widely disseminated in early Christianity. The church father Irenaeus quotes from it, and some early churches accepted it as canonical. This, by the way, is the gospel which Muhammad knows, and the miracle of the clay birds is ascribed to Jesus again in the Quran. The Infancy Gospel's miracles are so crude and so apparently uninstructive that it has been suggested that it was even created as disinformation, meant from the start to bring Christianity into disrepute. In modern times, it's been pressed into the same service. Voltaire, in the Philosophical Dictionary, summarizes this gospel among other gospels he considers forged, insinuating, of course, that all gospels are forged, that the biblical gospels are forgeries as well. At the very least, that they can't be trusted. Obviously, when the New Testament canon was being established, this infancy gospel did not make the cut, but it continued to circulate. Some of its miracles became staple subjects of medieval art. This is a panel from a church ceiling, a beautifully ornamented church ceiling in Switzerland. And it shows the boys at their work of making clay birds, and it shows Jesus's bird flying away. You can tell it's Jesus. The Apocryphal New Testament. What was this book? What had Mark Twain stumbled upon, as he says, if that is what happened, in New York in the library? The Apocryphal New Testament he was looking at was compiled and published by a man named William Hone in 1821. The controversy over Hone's edition is very revealing in connection with the use that Mark Twain is making of it. It sheds light on a curious and dangerous situation, which I would describe as the condition of resembling but not being the Bible. And that's what Apocrypha kind of is. Hone was a working-class Londoner, interesting figure, born in 1780, whose political sense was first excited by the French Revolution. He became a radical atheist and made a living as a journalist and a publisher. He was a friend of Charles Lamb and of Robert Southey and other literary people. He had scholarly interests, but not being of gentle birth, he couldn't really pursue them. He couldn't go to a university. So he lacked the ancient languages, which is definitely a barrier to learning in one of his many fields, which is the history of religion. The Apocryphal New Testament, which he published, proved very controversial. In our day, when alternative gospels and non-conforming religions are plentiful, it can be hard to understand the depth of the offense that was caused by a publication like Hone's. All it really did was reprint scholarly translations of two non-canonical gospels, together with a very dull selection from the church fathers. Why, then, is Hone's book publicly censured by the organs of church and state in the 1820s? Its offense was it was marketed to the common reader, and it was formatted to look like a Bible. Formatting may sound like a very up-to-date and postmodern word, but I think that's exactly what's at issue here. If you'll look at the page, you see that that this is not simply a reprint of some ancient classical texts, that this is meant to mimic your King James Bible as closely as possible with its italic chapter heads or summaries rather in the margin and the Roman numeral before. This is the gospel one infancy and broken out into verses. To publish apocryphal gospels was allowable, but to insinuate quasi-biblical status for them was not. it became a scandal. The Archdeacon of Derby thundered in print, "An enemy hath done this." More concretely, the Archdeacon wrote that the book was dangerous because it could serve as a convenient textbook of unbelief. It's interesting that this, you know, that this book of apocryphal gospels could be considered that way. But there is evidence that it became exactly that, a convenient textbook of unbelief. Here we are. This is a broadside printed in Iowa in the 1880s, much later. And it advertises the apocryphal New Testament, same book, in a later reprint, and calling it just the book to enlighten your Christian neighbor. We've hit grassroots working class free thought here. And this occurs, as you see, alongside an advertisement for the supreme irreligious book of the day, Whitman's Leaves of Grass, a famously irreligious and perverted publication which was banned in Boston and so forth. I have found Hone's apocryphal New Testament advertised throughout the century, that century and after, among other standbys in the in crummy basically in crummy publications, sort of among other collections of radical atheist and pornographic literature. I found these as late as 1912 in pages of magazines like the International Socialist Review. Hone's collection, indeed, is still in print and is easily found in bookstores today, usually as a paperback called The Lost Books of the Bible and the Forgotten Books of Eden. There was only one reason why William Hone was not tried for blasphemy when he published this book, and that is that the Crown had tried him for blasphemy 3 years earlier for publishing four pamphlets, and they had failed miserably. These pamphlets used the liturgical forms of the Church of England to attack corruption in public officials. Hone had been acquitted in a celebrated trial which made him famous and embarrassed the Crown badly. As for his production of 1821, these Gospels, in what did the imputed blasphemy consist? Well, as we saw, Hone's text was formatted to look like a Bible. The page is set in double columns and so forth. And it's translated into an archaic King James type literary texture. The obvious intention, according at least to the Archdeacon of Derby, was to deliberately entice people to mistake the book for canonical scripture. He said, "To place before the people spurious gospels as like in form and phraseology as they can be made to the originals is to foment infidelity." A writer in the Quarterly Review speculated that Hone's goal was to raise the positive evidence, he said, for the apocryphal writings as high as possible, because then another process for deducing the spuriousness of the New Testament is opened. And I think that's correct. I think that's the real source of the offense. All inquiry into origins risks a loss of mystique. Here is what the Quarterly Review was saying, in my words. If Hone prints the apocryphal scriptures very well, he expressly calls them apocryphal, consequently, it's okay to scoff at them and call them impossible. But the acute reader may ask, are they any more impossible than the legitimate Gospels? It is allowable to scoff at the apocryphal Gospels because they're advertised as apocryphal. But the scoffer may say, how do we know whether a scripture is genuine or apocryphal? What is the process by which that is done? The introduction to Hone's book dwells upon that scene, a church council at its work of compiling the Bible, and this scene Mark Twain harks back to as well. It starts off the preface to the Gospels book with a bang. After the writings contained in the New Testament were selected from the numerous Gospels and epistles then in existence, what became of the books that were rejected by the compilers? This note of resentment, sort of grassroots resentment, is very common in free thought literature. There's a political edge to it. It's not just saying, are these books, how were these books determined? They're saying, why was there no transparency to this process? Who decided what's in the Bible? The scholarly answer to that, by the way, is that we don't know. I mean, there are only theories about it. And what theory you put forward actually identifies you as a certain typically as belonging to a certain type of believer or unbeliever. So this picture of the church council at its work of compiling a Bible starts off Hone's book, and he's drawing attention from a democratic point of view to the fact that we're in the dark about the criteria by which Christianity sifted its extant scriptures. It's a point not lost on Mark Twain, who wrote this probably much later in the margin of his copy of Suetonius's Lives of the Caesars. Something on the page reminds him of what he calls here the early gospel winnowing, showing that he hadn't forgotten about this. I think he annotated this in the 1890s. And that volume is in the Mark Twain papers. The idea of a conclave of bishops sorting scriptures into piles, canonical and uncanonical, is a staple of polemic. That was specifically contested by a later editor of the New Testament Apocrypha, 100 years after Hone. That editor is M.R. James, who is more famous as an antiquarian and a ghost story author. Against Hone's invidious image of a coven of censoring bishops, James observes that the New Testament canon was formed gradually. And he says, by the end of the second century, we find the four Gospels in a secure position. Well, that may be true, but how did they get there? Agency has been obscured. The orthodox M.R. James is implying that canon formation is achieved through the operation of providence. Hone is looking for the human motives. Orthodoxy of James's sort was bound to frustrate inquiry into how the Bible is made. Because, as I mentioned, it is a strange fact that to know how something was made reduces our reverence for it. And that through that idea is how I want to bring us back to Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger manuscript. To know how something was made reduces our reverence for it. And isn't that the condition of Satan with regard to these people that he is, these little creations that he has given life to? The boys Satan understands, he knows how to create life, and so it holds no awe for him, and he destroys it without thinking about it, the same way we put the dishes into the dishwasher. The boys who observe Satan's slaughter of his creatures are horrified. The indifference of Satan challenges us to say why this is such a horror, to probe the deepest suppositions of morality. We recoil from senseless slaughter because life is precious. It is something we cannot create. It should not be wasted. But, says Mark Twain, if we belonged to Satan's species, the angels, and we were able to create life at will, we would value it not at all. Our reverence for life and our awe of death are products of our perspective. The kernel of this infancy gospel for Clemens lies in the recognition that the coming of an omnipotent child to a community would not be a cozy nativity scene, but a disaster for the community. The Christ child of the Gospels is tender and mild, but a real child is prone to jealousy, selfishness, rage, and if he should also be omnipotent, look out. The strategy of applying realism to scripture is, of course, a standby of free thought literature like Tom Paine, for example, and Mark Twain used it in many an unpublished manuscript. In the 1870s, he wrote a story, which he did not, of course, publish, called The Holy Children, in which three pious little girls are found to be able to grant prayers. Their prompt granting of every prayer in town causes chaos, a plague of irreconcilable miracles, and mayhem and death results on a massive scale. The holy children are hunted down and shot. It is the best Twilight Zone Mark Twain never wrote, and indeed I consider it not far from the classic modern treatment of this theme of the omnipotent child. You may recognize Billy Mummy, or Mummy, I don't know how, from the Twilight Zone as the little boy who is the omnipotent terror of his isolated town. In 1881, Mark Twain reworked The Holy Children as the Second Advent. The story now concerns the immaculate conception of a Messiah in contemporary Arkansas. By speculating on how moderns would react to the announcement of a virgin birth, Mark Twain critiques the evidence for the first one. 25 years later, in his autobiography, Twain was still unsatisfied. He wrote, "Mary's testimony satisfied Joseph. But that is because he lived in Nazareth, not in New York. There isn't any carpenter in New York that would take that testimony at par." This kind of naturalistic critique of supernatural claims is not unique to Twain. It's a staple of, again, of this kind of radical free-thinking stance. His approach is foreshadowed, as I just mentioned, by Paine's The Age of Reason, in which Paine asks us to imagine how it would really work out if, as the Gospel of Matthew says, at the crucifixion, the graves opened and the dead walked out. Tom Paine wants to know, I quote, "who the saints were that came to life again and went into the city, and what became of them afterward? Whether they came out naked and all in natural buff, he saints and she saints, or whether they came full dressed and where they got their dresses? Whether they went to their former habitations and reclaimed their wives, their husbands, and their property, and how they were received? Whether they entered ejectments for the recovery of their possessions, or brought actions of crim con against the rival interlopers? Whether they remained on the earth and followed their former occupation of preaching or working? Or whether they died again and went back to their graves alive and buried themselves?" 19th century literary realism has roots in the polemical realism of the 18th century deist thinkers like Tom Paine. But realism is just one facet of Mark Twain's program in these works. And Young Satan would concern us only briefly if it were a mere burlesque of conventional belief. Like the Jesus of the infancy gospel, Young Satan goes around dealing death. But unlike him, and despite the example of the clay people, his homicides are not usually wanton. Young Satan causes one boy to drown in the river, but what seems like cruelty is revealed to be a mercy killing. Satan can see into the future. The boy was headed for a crueler death, and Satan has provided him with an easier one. Reflecting on that, I think we're dazzled to realize that Mark Twain is presenting an orthodox proposition. The proposition that he had certainly heard in church, that what appear to be evils in the world are wrought by God for our benefit, if only we could see. In the light of the infancy gospel, the Chronicle stands forth as a disturbing and interesting achievement. A genuine success in parts. I say in parts because it is unfinished and because it's not clear where he was going to go with it, and besides which, it does break down into a certain episodic quality. But I think the wonderful thing about it that distinguishes it from some of his other treatments of the theme is that Chronicle of Young Satan is narrated by an ordinary human to whom Satan's and Mark Twain's gospel of nihilism is both irrefutable and unacceptable. The narrator, Theodore, about whom I haven't really said very much, but there isn't really very much to say about him, but we can say that Theodore is in no position to refute this angelic gospel. Neither can he live with it. Satan, through his arts of truth-telling, is able to show Theodore and his friends the violent history of mankind from the beginnings well into the future, from the time that Cain began it to the 19th century and beyond. When he does so and shows them the horrors of later times, Satan laughs in the most unfeeling way, Theodore says, although he knew that what he had been saying shamed us and wounded us. No one but an angel could have acted so. But suffering is nothing to them. They do not know what it is. Mark Twain's other expositions of his philosophy, and they are many, have not the resonance of this one, because this one acknowledges the effect on a healthy human being of Twain's angelic, demonic sort of detachment and the monstrous determinism of his worldview. Mark Twain presents his philosophy as unchallengeable. That's usual. What's different here is the tinge of drama. the angel's revelation reacts upon Theodore's response. The revelation evokes intellectual assent. Mark Twain's very persuasive about these things. But it reacts upon Theodore's response, which is human and parallels your own, probably, I hope, and that evokes emotional assent. This nihilist angel, sermonizing to a captive audience, is Samuel Clemens. Theodore is a village boy with limited views and expectations, and he is Samuel Clemens. The record of young Satan, narrated by his apostle, Theodore, dramatizes the situation. We must espouse this bitter philosophy, although we cannot endure it. Thank you. I can take questions if there are.
Right. I'll to remind the audience that they're listening to Ben Griffin, the radio and online audiences, at the Commonwealth Club, speaking about The Chronicle of Young Satan by Mark Twain. So,
the question I was talking to the fellow behind me is, how did Cal Berkeley become in possession of those daughters? What motivated Twain's daughter to give the papers to University of California?
Yeah, it's an interesting story, but it's a little frustrating because I can't fill it in at the most important point. The original intention, Clara Clemens's original intention was to leave his papers to Yale. Yale was the local great university for the Clemenses, who considered themselves in their happiest period as a family as Hartford, Connecticut people. Sometime in the 40s, Clara was prevailed upon by at least two very courtly and handsome members of the Berkeley English Department and the Bancroft Library to leave everything to Berkeley. I don't really know how that was. The interesting question is how, and I really don't know. But by that time, you know, Clara was a longtime California resident. She lived in San Diego, and maybe she had become fond of it. I don't think it has anything to do with Mark Twain having an important San Francisco period or California period in his life. But as of 1949, the papers had been moved provisionally to Berkeley, and over the next few years, a legal arrangement to leave them at her death was hammered out. But I can't be any more informative than that, I'm afraid.
Next question.
Hi, Gloria. When you were talking about, the religious paper that was written, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Right, and it was like, you know, coming from Iowa. I was kind of interested. The first thing that came to my head was like, you know, Iowa, and so goes the nation, right? What are your thoughts on that?
Wait, I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
In terms of politics and
religion. The religious paper from Iowa?
Yeah, you know, the
broadside
that I showed,
advertising the apocryphal gospels.
Yeah. I was kind of interested. That's kind of what came to my head. So Iowa goes, so goes the nation, right? Let's see what Iowa does in the voting. We're coming up to the voting coming up.
Oh, I don't know how long Iowa has had that reputation. I don't know that much about the history of American electoral politics. But... all I know is that this is a sort of hand-press grassroots publication. I wish there were more of them, but they're extremely ephemeral, obviously, being printed in small numbers and on hand presses in rustic areas somewhat. So I'm not really sure about that. It's a recent discovery, that handbill that I showed you. It was published only a few years ago, a couple of years ago, in a journal devoted to Whitman studies. And it was considered a big discovery. Yeah. Yes.
Next question.
How open was Twain about his atheism and his public talks? And he clearly didn't give much of a damn whether he annoyed or offended people. He made a practice of it. But within the context, his social context, How similar was he to other Americans of his time?
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I think, in the first place, he was very worried about offending people to the degree that it would redound against him. How he ever discovered how to walk the line, I mean, obviously, Mark Twain makes his public career saying things that are not what you say. I mean, that's the original Mark Twain joke, is that when someone brings up Sunday school, you say that you were fishing that day. I mean, that's not even funny, but it's because I'm not Mark Twain. He's better at it than I am. Well, he got there first. And it's very hard for me to understand why he didn't get into more trouble, you know, all the time. And in fact, you never find somebody saying, it's so difficult. I mean, I research this all the time, and I'm waiting for someone in the 1880s, around the time that Clemens publishes his account of his Civil War experiences, which is highly, you know, comical and discreditable to him, and that's the point. Is that he says I was a Confederate for 3 weeks. I didn't like retreat. I didn't like sleeping in the open, so I deserted. These are shameful, you know, shameful things on more than one count, perhaps. I keep looking for some letter to the editor in the newspapers saying, "Well, damn this guy Clemens. What is he but a Confederate turncoat who fled to Nevada to enrich himself when the rest of us were fighting and dying for freedom." No one ever says that. He's. I don't want to say that he's Teflon, but he did get in trouble sometimes. Never as much as he thought he might. And about his atheism, he was very secretive. I consider him an atheist. Not everyone does. There are you can have a Mark Twain scholar flown in here pronto, who will address you about Mark Twain's Christian orthodoxy. There are several who are making that case right now. I just don't happen to believe it, and I credit his private writings in a way that I don't credit his public pieties. Makes sense to me. But his private skepticism runs incredibly deep. But he didn't, in that age, to be an atheist, to be an unbeliever, a free thinker, whatever you want to call it, or even, it wasn't deadly to your public reputation to be rather tepid in your religion. I don't think anyone had much of a problem with that in the 1870s, 80s, 90s. But he didn't want to become known as the atheist writer like Emerson, you know, or Robert Ingersoll, people who just became notorious for atheism and were marked men. He had a family that he was supporting, and he always falls back on that. He always falls back on the stance, I'd love to tell the world what I think, and I would, but I'm supporting these three girls, and I have a wife, and we have a big house, and I have all these cows and things, you know. So he has an establishment to protect, and it's understandable. And he has no desire to become unpopular. So how he managed to just watching him throughout his lifetime parlaying, saying offensive things into being popular is amazing. I can't shed any light on it, really.
Two things. One is from Huckleberry Finn, where the main big moral conundrum is. He says, I'll go to hell. Mm-hmm. That also should have gotten him in more trouble than it did. I mean, became part of it, although parts of the novel got him in trouble and were banned a couple of times. But in general, he says that. I thought that was a pretty good.
And it did get him in trouble. I mean, yeah. It got the book in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, it got it banned. I mean, not necessarily just that passage.
Right.
But Huckleberry Finn was, it's controversial now, but it was controversial then for a different reason. It was controversial then because upright parents thought that their children would be dragged down into the lower classes by consorting with the narrator of that book,
right.
By consorting with Huck, who was low and used slang and disobeyed his parents and freed slaves and you know, was willing to go to hell.
The other thing was, I don't know do you know anything about a book? He said, who's come down on him? There was a book I ran across in a bookstore one time, very old one, called False Prophets by someone named Gillis. And I don't know if he's related to the Gillis brothers that were friends, but he listed a whole bunch of people who were false prophets. in religion, and he had a paragraph about Mark Twain. I mean,
oh, you're kidding.
4 or 5 pages about Mark Twain saying he was a false prophet. That's
really interesting, especially in connection with what I've been speaking about, his quasi-biblical resonances. I mean, of course, Mark Twain never set up as a prophet, but he set up as a quasi-prophet. Mm-hmm. You know, he in the same way that he's willing to set up as Methuselah or as the writer of a gospel. So that's really interesting. A false prophet. What decade is that supposed
to be from? It's like 1915. I think it was just a couple years after he died. And I think the Gillis was related to the two Gillis brothers he grew up with.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I'll next
question. I'm kind of curious to know, what were the social liabilities of coming out as an atheist back then or an agnostic?
I don't know how to answer. It happens so seldom that a public man, I think a lot of places seem to have had the village atheist, the Jude the Obscure type, you know? I have to be careful and think of America, not of England, because they're different, two different places. I think it's the most instructive example would be to look at Ingersoll. It's really interesting to see the way Ingersoll, who was an avowed atheist and became a senator from Illinois, I think. He had a stellar public career in the latter half of the 19th century in America. And he was well known as an atheist, and he wrote books about it, and he went around the country lecturing about atheism and how there's no God. He made a great success of it, and he was not mobbed or stoned. I don't know what that tells us.
I mean, doesn't that imply that maybe things haven't changed that much? That in fact society is, 30-40% atheist, and that it's always been that way? Is that possible?
There's never been a poll, you know, and there never will be one, that tells you how many people reject conventional religious beliefs, because they're most unlikely to tell a pollster. I mean, some of them will. Some of them will tell anybody. You know, I'm an atheist. You know, Christopher Hitchens type, the noisy atheist, the atheist who thinks he's really onto something. And it's, well, look what I found out. But these sociological questions are really hard for me to tackle. I feel like I don't know enough. I don't know enough. Does it show us that you could be an atheist and get away with it? Clemens didn't think you could. But it goes much farther than that, because like I keep saying, although he had a passionate interest in tweaking people's sensibilities and showing them where they're idiots, which is the satirist's stock in trade, he was morbidly afraid of losing his place in society, and of which he thought he had achieved by doing these things. And he, you know, when he thinks he's gone over the line, he's inconsolable, and you can see this in his letters. Like after he gave the speech in Boston, where he made fun of the three great poets of the day, the three great Boston poets. It's Emerson and John Greenleaf Whittier
and Longfellow.
Thank you. And he's inconsolable. He really enters a deep depression after there's a bad reaction to his tweaking of those three luminaries. He gets over it. And, you know, William Dean Howells is no help. I mean, Clemens had surrounded himself with immensely conservative and hidebound people. Some of them were great writers, like Howells. Some of them are just immensely conservative people who are, you know, part in the game. They're in the big game. And he didn't want to offend them. He didn't want to lose popularity. He wants it all. Yeah, absolutely. He was playing the game, but he's playing it on different terms. He's getting away with stuff that, you know, it's a great puzzle and it's a great adventure.
I don't want to take you off your field here, but I read Mark Twain. I read Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn for the first time about 4 years ago, and it seemed to me like there was some really kind of hotly homoerotic scenes in those books. Was this ever an issue in his time?
Do you feel this way about a lot of other books?
When they're swimming around naked and Tom Sawyer's getting hugged by Huckleberry Finn,
mm-hmm.
What else can you view that? Did anybody notice that at the time?
No, that case has been made. There's a biography of Mark Twain published about 15 years ago that makes the case that he had a well-developed homosexual personality, comes out in books like that one. And it's, you know, people always recur to the raft, the fact that Huck and Jim are naked when they can be on the raft. I never thought it seemed sexual per se, but I think we have to consider, for example, you know, in the 19th century, men shared beds very often without there being any imputation that this was lovemaking, you know. And so I think we have to think about that, but I have no desire to rescue Mark Twain from the imputation of having a gay, you know, side or personality.
That part doesn't, that's not what I'm concerned, I'm thinking about is how did, was he, by, how was he concerned by his temporaries? How did they?
Nobody gave it
this?
A second thought.
Okay, so maybe they
that's
were
easy,
more
that's easier
back
to
then.
Answer. Yeah. Oh, okay. No, that's not a charge. That's not a charge against him, as far as I'm aware, at any time. Cool. Like Whitman. Well, look what you had to do. I mean, you know, you had to signalize what you were talking about. You know, you had to be like Whitman if you wanted people to really ban that book.
Do you think at all that his faith belief or non-faith belief was influenced at all by his global travels? He was on the speaking circuit and exposed to all different cultures and people. Do you think that had any influence on him?
I don't. I think he was really set in his beliefs already. I mean, damagingly so, perhaps, you know, as people will be. But in his autobiography, he traces the beginnings of his atheism to when he was 5 years old and prayed for gingerbread, and it didn't come. And he says that, so he's a rationalist, you know, he's been running, and an empiricist, he's been running experiments. I prayed for it, I'm a nice guy, I'm sinless, I was 5 years old, you know, and it didn't come. And you know, he wasn't satisfied when people said to him, well, it's mysterious, you know, and you never know. I mean, sometimes you get gingerbread. That wasn't good enough. So, no, I think the roots of his free thinking go further back to when he was much younger. Yeah. He said that, of course, famously, that travel was fatal to prejudice and other, I can't remember the exact quote. But I really think that he had already formulated a basically totally secular worldview by the time he was a teenager. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier the Second Advent story, the way the other story, the Holy Children, had been turned into. That's the one where when the prophet or the Messiah grows up, he goes around and performs miracles, and each one goes wrong.
Right.
Each one has to be undone. He cures everybody, and then the doctors are
the
mad.
Doctors are out of, yeah. are angry at him.
And,
yeah,
and then he makes them sick again, and then the undertakers get mad because nobody dies, even
right.
though they're sick.
It throws everything into chaos.
I attended a concert a couple of days ago with a wonderful group of women who were singing holiday songs from the 11th, 12th, and 13th century. And there was one song that struck me because I've always been puzzled by the same problem. It was about dear old Joseph. And the story went, Joseph was wondering, I've led a good life, I've been chaste, my wife's pregnant, what's happening? And Gabriel comes down and says, back off, the big guy's got everything under control. And it's so ripe with satire, and this is from this song was from the 12th century. Did Mark Twain ever do anything with poor old Joseph? Because I often wonder too.
Yeah,
this
he
guy,
harks back to Joseph
perfect,
all the time.
A perfect Mary, a perfect family, and yet he's been actually cuckolded by divine grace, but still he's been cuckolded.
I quoted a remark about Joseph just now from Mark Twain's autobiography, where he says that no carpenter in New York would take that evidence seriously. Which problem do you see as basic?
Relationships, she's pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And this angel comes down and says, back off, big boy.
Yeah. I don't know. I have a Richard Pryor album where he tackles that. This is Joseph made the... You know. Mary said, God made the baby. You know. It's great too. I'm trying to remember which album. I think it's the album's called Craps After Hours. It's really funny.
You mentioned the word deism. I have wondered if some of these political figures, the founding fathers, Tom Paine, didn't fall back on deism as a way of satisfying religion without saying that there's any rationality anymore.
Yeah, they did, in my opinion. That's exactly what they were doing. I mean, the founding fathers seem to have lived secular lives, believing, you know, not exactly putting their trust in providence. They trusted their own farms and their own guns and you know, their own political revolutions and their own political ideas. But I'm sure that they saw it. But you know, but in the 18th century, it's still possible to practice a religion, a Christianity, that is whittled down to a sort of belief that someone made the universe and set it in motion, and we give due reverence to that guy without necessarily believing that the Book of Common Prayer is, that we have to read from the Book of Common Prayer, or that we have to, you know, follow everything that's in the Gospels. So it's a long process by which a deist religion was formulated, but I do think it has, it could satisfy people who have a need for some religion, but not very much. And it can satisfy politicos who believe that you have to provide some kind of ethical, religious, moral, cosmological framework to keep people satisfied and to keep them from questioning your prerogatives. Yeah. Is that about what you're thinking? Yeah, I think that's right. I think that is the faith of the founding fathers. Yeah.
I'd add one other thing. And to keep them from murdering each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Next question.
Is there any truth? Have you ever heard that Mark Twain and Bret Hart were the founding members of the Bohemian Club?
I have heard that, but I don't think it's true. Yeah. I don't think Mark Twain has any connection to the Bohemian Club, actually.
I think there's about a 10-year difference between his time in San Francisco and the start. Yeah. Something like that. But he behaved like a Bohemian.
For a while.
And that's probably why, yeah.
And there was an interesting book just published about that, too.
Yeah, exactly. We had him come and speak.
Oh, you had Ben Tarnoff, the author of The Bohemians, yes.
I have a question for you about how you got started on this part of your research. What did you come across that made you dip into this area of his writing? Or was that something you were interested in before you even started working at the market?
I'm trying to remember. I've been thinking about it and working on it for years. I can't actually remember how I got started on this. I think it's just it must have got started because I'm just interested in the Bible and how great writers receive and transmute biblical texts. I've always been interested in the biblical apocrypha, mm-hmm. ever since I first read Ridley Walker. Anybody read Ridley Walker? God, what a wonderful book! It's by Russell Hoban, better known for his children's books about badgers. Bread and Jam for Francis, and then mm-hmm. he wrote The Mouse and His Child. He was a wonderful writer. He's dead now. Russell Hoban, and he has his greatest book is a science fiction, a post-apocalyptic sci-fi book that I won't bore you with details about, called Ridley Walker. And Ridley Walker has an epigraph at the front with a verse that was ascribed to the apocryphal New Testament. It was such a fascinating verse that I became obsessed with. But that was in 1979. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my interests are deeply rooted.
Sounds like the origin story, yes. Next. Anybody else have another question?
Okay. That sounds like it. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Ben. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club, and it's 113th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much, Ben. That was a great talk.